ask the questions anyway.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is...
I'm Richard Higgins, and I currently live in Florence, but to the extent that I have a day job nowadays, I'm an emeritus professor. I work in the Brussels School of Governance in the heart of Europe. So,
the heart of official Europe.
Official Europe, yeah.
And Richard, we've only known one another, I was thinking about it the other day, for 43 years.
Is it that little time?
I think so. I think we met at a political science conference in 1981. In fact, I'm sure that's true. And even though I can guess what your answer might be, for those listeners who have not known you for 4.5 decades, could you share with us what are the things that are currently dynamizing, concerning, interesting you? What's happening?
Well, there's two ways to answer that. One is, I suppose, partly personal and autobiographical, and the other way is in a more kind of scholarly measured approach. But for the last few years, because as you know, I spent 20 years not teaching while I was a university bureaucrat. And so I refer to myself as a recovering academic over the last 10 years. And I went back to teaching international politics. And what dynamizes me, what depresses me, is that in the 50 years since I first gave my first undergraduate lecture, I've spent 45 of those years teaching international politics, where you could argue that basically it was two steps forward, one step back, but progressively some things were changing: decolonization process, end of the Cold War, growth of the European Union. The last 5 years, I'm convinced that the whole thing is becoming unraveled, and this depresses me. And it depresses me for two reasons. One is that I can't do anything about it apart from teach about it. And I'm getting progressively known in the Brussels policy community, where I do a lot of public speaking, as Cassandra. And I don't like being Cassandra because I'm essentially, as you know, I'm a kind of a glass half full, not glass half empty kind of character. But I am of the view that we are, and I will not use any of those cliches like inflection point or watershed moment or anything like that. But we are, I think, in a state of dislocation in the nature of the global structure of international relations that is probably more, I don't know whether trepidatious is a word or not, but it's probably more fragile than at any time in the last, certainly since the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so this is what exercises me. And it's both a general concern as a student of international relations, but it's a personal concern too. And I think one of the things that I think you want to talk about, where it's very personal for me, for example, has been in the change of what's happened to what we might call the economic, political, and strategic culture of the Pacific, the Asia-Pacific, East Asia, however you want to describe it. I'm very uncomfortable using the idea of the Indo-Pacific. So that's where it's a personal thing for me. So these are my academic concerns. But they're also my personal concerns too, because one of the things I notice about my students, and this could get me into trouble here saying this, I ask my students why they're not more angry than they are. And I try to illustrate by talking about what I was like as a grad student at the London School of Economics in the early 70s. I don't know, we were angry about everything. But some things don't seem to make my students angry. Now, I have not been teaching since Gaza. So I'm going back to teach in a couple of months' time. It'll be the first time I've talked to students since then. And if anything can get them angry, then I'm assuming that can. But by and large, they don't get angry over the nature of global inequality. They don't get angry over the nature of exploitation. They don't get angry over, for example, the way in which the world is run by, for want of a better expression, narcissistic, sociopathic men. And it's very interesting for me. I don't know how frivolous we can be on a podcast like this, but
as you wish, Prof. As you
wish.
Well,
I mean, I'm kind of put into this obvious class of being an old white European male, but I'm actually angrier about the nature of the domination of the global cooperation system by sociopathic, narcissistic males than almost anybody I know who's 20 or 30 years younger than me. So it's a difficult call whether I'm just a grumpy old man or whether I'm a seriously still functioning, hard-thinking intellectual about the major problems of world order.
So, well, I think you're both.
I'll leave it to you, Tony.
I think you're both, old thing. Now, in order to, achieve part of that status myself, I'm going to fill my glass. But I wonder if we could focus on, for a moment, on one aspect in particular of what you were describing, which is the last 5 years. So I'm throwing myself back to 2019 or thereabouts. Mm. What's gone on in that period that's so destabilizing in your view? And then a related question, what's been destabilized? Because when I read Lamentations for the Old International Order, in terms of whatever that can mean, be it Bretton Woods or Pax Americana or whatever, mm. I don't have a great nostalgia for it, personally.
No, I agree with that too. But what I think the difference is, and I think 2019 is not a bad point to think about it, onset of COVID, these kinds of things, is, and what I tried to do in that book that we were talking about, State Civilizations, it has, the subtitle is The Reset of World Order. So there's a book that was out of date before it more or less hit the. I mean, I looked at the book for the purposes of having this conversation with you, and some things have changed dramatically, and other things are just simply more of the same. And you're quite right. What was happening was that the old world order was always, as you know, it was never liberal. It was always only partially liberal, underwritten by what I call American self-binding hegemony, not some kind of, and it was always only partial. And the best book on this, so that you and I can wallow in nostalgia, is Amitav Acharya's 2014 book on Future of the American World Order. And Amitav got it dead right, what was coming unraveled. And the word I was using in the book was the unraveling of world order. And like you, I recognize that not everything in it was perfect. But some of the things that we are unlearning are a bit disturbing. And they're to do in some ways, not with the institutional structures, because the Bretton Woods system and the UN system were clearly the structures of post-World War II American hegemony, but the way we think about things, the way we moralize about things. And you know, even though it's literature that's 40 years old now, and even though we kind of think of them as very classically American political scientists, those people who wrote about the importance of institutions, not in a physical bricks and mortar sense, but in a sense of learning, of cooperation, the importance of empathy and systems building. We're losing those elements that I thought we were creating. So there's a total lack of empathy anywhere in international relations now. And to be cliched about it, the emotional and personal style of Donald Trump fits basically the emotional and personal style of many other dominant leaders, whether it's Putin, whether it's Xi Jinping, whatever, people like Erdogan, for example, Mohammed bin Sultan, these kind. So we're losing even the basic ability to communicate globally. Now, I've got a view on this that in some ways, and I've just published a chapter in a book that you'd be quite interested in. Basically, the argument is, and it's not a gender-based argument, because I wouldn't be so presumptuous to make a gender-based argument. But the problems we've got is that most of the deliberations and the consultation about decision making, more than simply one-on-one decision making, is driven by narcissistic characters who have a zero-sum transactionalist view, with only basically bilateral concerns as part of their outcome and their desires. And so I think we're losing even any of that kind of spirit of a cooperative dialogue over the last 5 or 6 years, irrespective of whether the institutions are good or bad or indifferent. And we've got to start rethinking that and rebuilding that.
Now, Prof H, when I was going to say preparation H, sorry. Prof H, when we first met, you were an indefatigable Africanist. And one of the things about some of the literature on Africa is the SE Finer, City Finer notion of the sort of big man on campus, the
The man
strong
on
on the
horseback.
horse. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess what's happened is that that model, in Weberian terms of charismatic leadership in a nationalistic frame, has become something of a norm. And not just a norm in places that are not of immense geopolitical significance, like Hungary, but in places that really matter. The three you mentioned, China, the United States, Russia, right?
I distinguish between Russia and China, by the way. Russia, I consider basically to be a spoiler that wants to bring the whole system down. Putin has a view of his own world, and he doesn't care what happens so long as he can have his sphere of influence. The Chinese are different. They don't want to bring the world system crashing down. They want to revise it in a way that suits them better. Unfortunately, there's this marriage of convenience between Putin and Xi Jinping, that I think prevents us from having a much more cooperative China in a global context. It doesn't need to be. Let me just say one thing, that I resist the idea that we're heading into a new Cold War, for example. We are not heading into a new bipolarity with Russia, with China, and the United States. And the reason we're not is because Cold Wars were tightly disciplined, and the two dominant powers had their allies who stuck well to them inside their structures. The system is fuzzy nowadays. It's bifurcated. Players much more are willing to hedge, wedge, swap between bandwagoning with one state on security, but then balancing with the other state on economy. The idea that there is a tight bipolar system is a nonsense. With a guy called Simon Reich, I wrote a piece where we talked about a bifurcated world order, and the fuzzy nature of that order. So that's the system we live in. So there's going to be even less order in the future than there was in the past. And it's not as if it's going to be swapped, as some people think would be a good idea, for a multipolar order with three different kind. That's not going to happen. It's going to be messier and fuzzier than
Now,
that.
Prof, one of the things that the pro-China lobby, as it were, or pro-China people who say we can have peaceful coexistence, let's stop trade wars, let's stop militarization. It seems to me one issue about that discourse in the Anglo world is that there are people in Japan, South Korea, Vietnam, the Philippines, you name it, who at some level really want US hegemony at a military level to protect them. Taiwan, obviously, is another. These people are also Asian. Some of them are also Chinese. And they know China a little bit better than a lot of us do.
No, and I think that's right. And I am not one of these naive people who believes that if you treat them well, they'll treat. I mean, China has global aspirations. China behaves badly. Its human rights record is appalling. The way it controls its own societies. This is nothing. I mean, I'm too much of an old-fashioned liberal to be comfortable with the nature of that kind of behavior. What I'm concerned about, though, and I don't think this makes me a Sinophile, what I'm concerned about is I think that in this shift towards this intellectual geopolitical agenda of the current era, we're engaging in a self-fulfilling prophecy. We're engaging in the generation of threat inflation, for want of a better expression. Interestingly, an expression I first heard from one Michael McKinley. So, just to give you a blast from the, but the man's got a point. I mean, we're talking up. I mean, if you take, for example, the shift in the dialogue from the idea of the Asia Pacific as a region of economic cooperation, integration, and growing trade, to the idea of the Indo-Pacific as a geopolitical region of alliance building, China thwarting activities like AUKUS. It's like we've got a wish fulfillment. It's like a self-generating prophecy. And you and I, given our Australian histories, we're both very aware of the degree to which the strategic culture of a country like Australia has changed dramatically over a period of about 10 years, where it's gone from seeing itself as a good international citizen, a creative and constructive middle power, back to the period where it is now little more, I mean, and I use the words reluctantly, but as a comfortable client state of the US. I mean, we're old enough to remember expressions like all the way with LBJ. Well, it's not much different nowadays. And that's where my concern with China is. Not that China's some great benign despot some great benign new power who's misunderstood. But we do understand it, but we're in the process. We're generating an animosity that I just don't see as being necessary at the moment.
Now, this is interesting. At one level, it's to raise another friend of ours from the past, Peter Boyce. It's a certain nostalgia for old style diplomacy, I think, too. Even if it's, to use Macmillan's term, arm and parley. But, Prof, I wanted to focus for a moment. We'll go back to the State Civilizations book on your new piece, and I'm reading from the front cover, which, by the way, folks, is available for free download. The decline and rise of hegemonic narratives from globalization and the, in inverted commas, Asia Pacific, close inverted commas, to geopolitics and the, inverted commas, Indo-Pacific, close inverted commas. And you've already mentioned this Indo-Pacific conceit. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about your arguments in this piece, which is terrific, always well written and always well sourced? One of the great pleasures of reading Richard Higgott is that not only does the prose teach you a lot and do so in an elegant form, but it's backed up with lots of other stuff you can go and read that'll either reinforce or not Richard's points.
Oh, I like to think my footnotes reinforce my points, but
Depends
you
who's
could be,
reading them, pal.
you
Depends who's reading
yeah.
them.
Okay, that's what I did was I juxtaposed what I called hegemonic narratives, and the hegemonic narrative that basically prevailed from the end of the Cold War until, if you like, the global financial crisis of 2008, was the globalization narrative. The idea that, and particularly the neoliberal Hayekian narrative that basically said the less you interfere in the market, the better things get. And they provide substantial empirical evidence to demonstrate that neoliberal Hayekian economics was the most dramatic wealth generator the world has ever known. And it did indeed bring close to 1 billion people out of poverty in the developing world. But of course, by ignoring the downside of globalization, by only focusing on this upside of globalization, by ignoring the downside, they let the seeds of globalization's own problems grow, particularly inequality, particularly the dispossession of the material living standards of the advanced, especially in the United States, manufacturing sectors, but also in Europe. And they ignored the politics of it. They basically forgot that when we talked about embedded liberalism, remember John Ruggie's notion about embedded liberalism? I always liked the way it was described as Smith abroad and Keynes at home. Well, what the neoliberal Hayekian globalization did was it forgot the Keynes at home bit. And by forgetting the Keynes at home bit, it challenged the social democratic consensus and gave rise to the growth of populism, nationalism, identity politics, anti-immigration, all of those kinds of things. So that hegemonic narrative of globalization challenged itself by only dealing or only contemplating what was good and ignoring what was bad. And so, for example, if you want one kind of pinpoint moment in this, I always, when Hillary Clinton decided that all these people who had been dispossessed by the deindustrialization of globalization were deplorables. And it generated this political, but it was the same in Europe, Western Europe too. And so that narrative came under challenge. Now, don't misunderstand me. Globalization is not dead. The dynamics of economic liberalism still pertain. But what, of course, we are seeing is we are seeing an inward-looking strategy now that talks about decoupling, de-risking, onshoring, cutting China out of the supply chains, all that kind of stuff. And the opposite side of that is the growing hegemonic narrative of geopolitics. As you know, in the paper, I talk about the autumn of globalization and the springtime of geopolitics. And suddenly, I mean, this as you will come as no surprise to you, I'm in a center for strategic and development studies, and it's full of security specialists. And they're my friends, and we get on well, but I'm the outlier in this community, because for the security specialists, geopolitics is for the security specialists what globalization was for the economists. It gave them the predominant polar position in the policy discourse. And so we now have in the Indo-Pacific what I would call the dominant policy discourse of geopolitics, and it's put the security types in the driver's seat. So again, and this metaphor or this description will horrify both sides. I would argue that the concept of the balance of power is to the security specialist what the concept of the equilibrium is to the economist. Everything they do is built around this concept. And it's driving the nature of the international relations debate in the Indo-Pacific now, the debate about geopolitics. So, Spykman, Morgenthau, Brzezinski, and of course the early boys like Halford Mackinder, they're all flavor of the month nowadays. The original geopolitics people. And so this is what I mean about one hegemonic narrative taking over from the other hegemonic narrative. It doesn't mean the other one's disappeared, but we're talking about the balance of influence in if you like, in the foreign policy and international relations decision-making context.
Now, that means whilst in the real world, as it were, There may not be a Cold War. People are being dredged out who are the proverbial cold warriors of their era, are they not? And you
True.
mentioned Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the Democrats' answer to Kissinger, and may end up turning out to be a more consequential figure than Kissinger because of the way he embroiled the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. That's the his imagined, mimesis of the Vietnam conflict. But this is pulling those guys out from the past who were largely forgotten. So it is a Cold War binarism again, isn't it?
It's an intellectual binarism.
Right.
What it's not is it's not tight. That's why I don't use the polarity argument.
Okay.
I don't. But if we look at, I got that quote from Keynes at the beginning of that
Yes,
paper
lovely.
about the importance of ideas being much more than people recognize. And the one thing I think is lovely about that paper, that quote, he says the ideas of economists and political philosophers, when they're right and when they're wrong. Now, during the neoliberal Hayekian period, I've seen that quote many times, and for some reason, political philosophers is left out of the. There's three little dots in the quote. So it says the ideas of economists, dot, 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 when they're right and when they're wrong. So I can even send you a couple of references to that, Toby. But the importance of ideas in these narratives is what I'm on about.
Yeah,
Not
sure.
a bipolar political system, but the degree to which they affect the strategic culture of states. Just to give you one tiny little empirical example, or a nice one from the United States, you remember that during the height of the Cold War, there was something called the Committee for the Present Danger, colon Soviet Union. Now, that committee folded. It was reinstated about 6 years ago as the Committee for the Present Danger, colon China. And in order to avoid any kind of libel or anything like that, the guy who was the last chair of the Committee for the Present Danger, Russia, is the chair of the current Committee for the Present Danger, China. So there is, to take your point, there is a continuity of people as well as ideas. So, but the
Yeah.
other thing that I think is important is that this ideas base is not just in the policy community. You find it in what we might call the wider non-governmental policy community, in the think tanks, in the research institutes, and these kinds of places, around the Beltway, for example. And I provide examples in the paper of these kinds of so. And it's an ideas debate. That's what you could say that I'm an old-fashioned academic who's interested in ideas rather than. But these ideas, I would argue, cast massive policy shadows, and they provide the legitimation for policy.
Oh, I don't think that can be doubted in the context not only of what Keynes said, Keynes' own example, but also the Cold War, neoliberalism, and so on. These involved the major transformation of thinking on the part of people in university departments, in policy-making positions, and in political parties. I wanted to touch on Australia for a moment. A place that I used to know a lot about and really don't know very much about at
Well, I'm
all.
the same. I'm watching it from Europe.
Yeah. So, for those who don't know, in I think 1950, there was signed an alliance called ANZUS, that was the acronym Australia, New Zealand, United States, which was meant to be like NATO, except 20 years later, the Australians and New Zealanders discovered it wasn't because
Well,
Nixon
the difference is
said.
there's no Article 5 in ANZUS.
And
Whereas NATO has Article 5.
he enunciated the Guam Doctrine, where he said, if it doesn't suit us, fuck you if you get attacked.
Yes.
Anyway, they had that, and it was meant to be their shield. It was meant to be their way of keeping basically Australia and New Zealand from becoming too Asian slash Maoist, but most of all, probably too Asian. And they had their reasons for feeling afraid because of both what had happened with Japan in the war and also what had happened in Korea and the Chinese Communist Revolution the year before. Now, as you mentioned, there's a new formation, the acronym AUKUS, is that how it's pronounced?
AUKUS, yeah, AUKUS.
Right. And this once more seems to be we're here to be used in any way you want, Daddy, attitude to the United States and its military establishment.
Kurt Campbell, who was the head of the East Asia Division of the State Department, said that one of the strengths of ANZUS from the US point of AUKUS, sorry, from the US point of view, was it ties Australia into us for the next 40 years. He used that expression. The quotation is in the paper.
Well, Hollywood studios used to refer to Australia as Mexicans with mobiles.
I've
In other
never
words,
heard that.
it's a great expression, although, of course, there are more cell phones in Mexico than in Australia now, but it's a great expression. In other words, they'll do what they're told. But my question is, and again, I'm very out of touch, Paul Keating, a former Australian Prime Minister,
Who you've got to
is
love.
Mr. China now. And has
Truly.
waded into all kinds of debates, saying it's old-fashioned and stupid to regard China as a geopolitical threat. We should be trading with them. We should tone down the criticisms and so on, and in fact, not make them. So I wondered if you could perhaps respond to that, but also in the context of what I said earlier, Vietnam, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, places that know a lot more about China than he does,
And
are very concerned.
they're also a lot closer to China than Australia is, for God's sake, as well. No, look, you've touched on a really interesting thing. And what's interesting is when AUKUS, for listeners who might not, and I'm conscious that you do have Australian listeners, so I've got to get it accurate, get it right. AUKUS, basically, there are two elements to it. It's embarrassing because it looks like the Anglosphere rejuvenated. Because the Brits are in it. And basically, it's one to provide nuclear powered submarines at some stage in the future, probably not before, were it to survive before 2040. But there's also a technological development pillar to it as well. So it's a big thing. But the crucial thing about it is that it fits perfectly with the US's Indo-Pacific strategy of binding partners to it. The Brits are in it because the Brits want to be in anything since they got out of Europe, and I find it vaguely embarrassing. And there's a very distinguished and very I hope I'm not ruining his reputation. There's a very distinguished, very good Australian strategist called Hugh White, who has written this wonderful piece on why AUKUS is destined to fail. And he gives a whole range of reasons, but three I think are quite important. One, which is probably the less important one, but the one that makes me laugh most, is his idea that somehow the Brits will finish their part of the project on time and on budget. He says this is just ludicrous to even think about this. The more important reason he gives is that in the long run, the US cannot be guaranteed to adhere to this process, even with continuance, for example, of a democratic administration. The expense of it, the lack of earlier submarines to transfer to Australia, simply not available. And indeed, of course, Donald Trump to be returned, then the whole future of something like AUKUS is on the agenda again. Now, the problem with it, I see, and I'm not as pro-China as Keating is, but Keating is sensible to the extent of not overhyping the China threat. He's not trying to see another domino theory or the return of the yellow peril, as some people do. I know we shouldn't talk about things like that, but There are, I've seen stuff in the Australian literature where scaremongers use expressions like that. But what Keating is saying that is sensible is that you don't need to accept that China is a benign state in order to be able to manage your relationships with them. And you had a throwaway comment earlier about diplomacy. One of the things, I mean, and if Peter was around nowadays, one of the things that he would be saying, and I would agree, is we've forgotten how important diplomacy is. We've forgotten how important talking to people is. And there is a lot that can be done through communication. And one of the things that I draw some comfort from is the growth of actors other than China and the United States that are becoming key players. If, for example, you look in the Asia Pacific region at the role of Indonesia, Indonesia has not thrown its toys out of the pram completely over AUKUS, but it's made it quite clear that its attitude towards China is not the same as that in the, if you like, in the geopolitical coda of the US Australia Indo-Pacific analysis of the world. I wrote a book with a couple of Canadian friends 35 years ago now on Australia and Canada as responsible middle powers. It died a death after about 10 years, as indeed it should have done. And I thought we'd put to bed for good the idea of the middle power. One of the ironies of the last few years is suddenly this concept in international relations is becoming much more salient again. I mean, when I'm getting invited to conferences in Asia at the moment, they want me to talk about middle powers. And it's not something that I've thought about since I finished writing that book 30 odd years ago. But if you think about it, and some of them wouldn't like to be called middle powers. I mean, the Turkish would not like to be called a middle power, for example. The Indonesians, they're not too upset about being called middle power. Koreans think of themselves as middle, but South Koreans think of themselves as middle powers. Thailand, it's a different group of actors. And the thing about them is that they will not simply toe the line of one great power or another, which is why we need to think of the world mess. Again, to come back to a colleague and friend of ours from 40 years ago, Amitav Acharya, probably our most distinguished junior colleague from all those years ago, he's got this shtick that he talks about now called multiplexity as a way of trying to describe world order rather than using the polarities. He uses multiplexity. And he's working on this and he's redefining it. And there's a special edition of International Affairs with 20 papers on multiplexity coming out in the next 6 to 8 months. That's a more interesting way of thinking about the nature of world order.
Now, in terms
Sorry,
of
I'm rambling.
diplomacy and middle powers, when the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade was going through its last iteration, the Punta del Este round becoming the World Trade Organization,
The
which, by the
Euro
way,
round, yes.
is held up with a record number of complaints against China by India, something for BRICS addicts to think about. Australia and Canada, and this is something you know about very well, were intimately involved in the so-called Cairns Group because, apart from anything else, they had embassies everywhere.
Yep.
Or if they didn't have them
And
everywhere,
they had
they had reached
skilled technicians and negotiators,
skilled technicians and negotiators,
people who knew about trade.
and they had people in embassies who, if they weren't in every country in a continent, there were three or four in a continent and they would scoot around and do things. Is that still important as a middle power?
Well, that's an interesting question because one of the, I mean, you know, I wrote about the importance of the Cairns Group as a third force in the Uruguay agricultural trade negotiations. And in the last instance, even though they helped set the agenda, in the last instance, the Americans and the Europeans cut a deal over their heads, which basically made me think maybe I've overemphasized the importance of these kinds of things. But what is becoming increasingly, and this is where something like the BRICS, or everyone gets really snooty about using concepts like the Global South or the BRICS. And I think that we're quite right not to think of them as rigorous institutional, definitional concepts of utility. But where we should think of them as being functionally quite useful is commonalities of thought emerge. I mean, if you take something like this Russian invasion of Ukraine, as you will know, not a single Latin American state or a single African state joined the American sanctions regime against Russia in this context. This wasn't because these states thought the Russian invasion was appropriate. It wasn't because they supported the Russian invasion. It was because they thought that this necessarily couldn't do anything other than antagonize things. And they weren't prepared to slavishly adhere to one side or the other. So the issue is, if issue-specific coalition building, which is what we how we described the Cairns Group when we wrote about it, if issue-specific coalition building can work, then it can be important. And at the moment, there are not many vehicles for doing this. But that's got to be one of our ways forward in the long run if we are going to reset world order in the next few years.
One
in
of
a
the challenges
non-conflictual way.
For that, presumably, is this. The so-called Washington Consensus, the World Bank will lend you money, but you've got to stop having a welfare state. The International Monetary Fund will lend you money, but you've got to do the same. Those sorts of so-called structural adjustments and the bogey people for the left of those multilateral institutions and later the WTO, though, of course, it didn't have the implicit enforcement mechanisms of the IMF and the World Bank. There's an argument today running around that says, actually, none of those actors matter because international finance is so footloose and so outside any kind of governmental control that the idea of an international order simply doesn't apply.
I think that's right. I don't think we think of the Washington Consensus in the way we used to think about it. I mean, and again, it's something I wrote about and I was critical about. In fact, I don't even think of the bank and the fund in those ways now. And one of the interesting things, if you look at World Bank funding over the last 2 years, they've diverted 30% of their funding to Ukraine that would have normally gone to developing countries. So it's a tool in a wider game. The other thing, of course, is that these institutions were thought to function because we lived in an open, liberal economic system. The new Washington Consensus, courtesy of Jake Sullivan, who described it as such, is basically the return of industrial policy and protectionism. So the system is closing in that sense. That is the major challenge to globalization. I mean, not everything globalization did was bad. And some of the major beneficiaries from it were developing countries. But that is turning in on itself. That is one of the major problems that we face. Nationalism, identity politics, geopolitics is causing us to turn away from openness and liberalism. Liberalism shouldn't be a dirty word. Neoliberalism, I've never been comfortable with. But the idea of open, free exchange, the idea of a recognition of human rights, the idea of a free press, all those elements of the liberal order are not bad things. The problem we had was that in the heyday of unipolar hegemony and the Cold War, we wanted to universalize these things and see them as forces for imposition. Now, this is why I'm pessimistic, to come back to my, because I'm
Yes.
conscious of time, to come back to my opening comments. I wrote a paper that you may not have read, Can We Save Liberalism from Itself? I'll send it if you've not
Oh,
seen.
I may have it. Let me have a look through a little far, but carry on.
I think you
Yeah.
did, because I think I sent it you to comment on. But anyway,
Yes, you did.
that's the big question. What can we save of liberalism that's worth having? And there are lots of things that are worth having, but whether we can save them or not is a big, and quite frankly, the people who are saving it are snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. A classic example would be Biden's democracy versus authoritarianism campaign. That is not having the effect that he wanted. Quite the opposite. So, anyway, I'm conscious of.
No, well, I want to ask you one more question, if I may, Prof. H, and then throw to you to add anything to what you've already discussed or to introduce new topics. Yeah. So I wanted to cast your mind back 40 years and then forward 40 years. I want you to juxtapose your pathbreaking early book on political development theory with your pathbreaking very recent one, State Civilizations and the Reset of World Order. What's changed in your form of thinking across
Well,
that period?
that's an interesting question. Let me say two things. First, I think you're being overly generous calling them pathbreaking. But if I look at the first book that I wrote and the second book that I wrote, the one common thread for me is I'm still more optimistic than most people. But having said that, my optimism at the time when I wrote the political development book was that I was naive enough to think that we could have some kind of synthesis between the egalitarian agendas of a new international economic order and what I considered to be those sensible elements of Weberian rationalism in terms of how we ordered and managed society. And if I look back at it, some elements of Weberian rationalism have come through, a lot hasn't. Dependency theory and the demand for a new international economic order disappeared for 30 or 40 years. But one of the things about growing old, Toby, is if you hang around long enough, things seem to come back with a second life. There's a lot more written about dependency theory nowadays and the need to basically say that we didn't succeed in doing away with colonialism, and many of the structures still prevail. In the last book, I think my big argument there, and several have stood the test, although the two big things that undermined that book was, one, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and two, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So, but if you think about the big principles that were in the book, the one was, I said it was no longer adequate to basically have two problematics of how we explain the world. Either a political economy problematic or a geopolitical security problematic. We needed a cultural, civilizational problematic to explain the world as well. And I think that that's clearly something that people now recognize. You can't push culture and identity and all these kinds of things. And civilization, especially as China and India and lesser states, by lesser, I mean smaller, states like Turkey, have begun to re-argue their civilizational contexts. So that I think is important. Where I think I got the book wrong is I'm too optimistic about the prospects for rebooting the multilateral institutional structure. And if you remember the book, I finished up with 10 propositions. And of the 10 propositions, I'm not going to go through them all, but of the 10 propositions, eight of them have got stronger rather than weaker since then. My first proposition was that liberalism is in crisis. Well, that's a lot worse than it was. My second proposition was that sovereignty as an organising principle is becoming more and more rhetorically important. In some ways, at the time when it's becoming more of a kind of a fiction, given the impact of, well, for example, social communication, digitalization, those kinds of things, to go into a domain that you're comfortable with. My third argument was that US leadership, to the extent that it was leadership rather than enforcement, is in decline, and that managing cultural differences is important was my fifth. And there are a couple of others. So there's a continuity at one level, but there's a big distinction between the way I see, for example, when I was a PhD student, the early 1970s, and I wrote on Africa, you know, I was an Africa fan. And I suffered from what Ali Mazrui used to call, he referred to Tanzophilia as the opium of the Afrophiles, which I thought was a wonderful and I was one of these people who believed that decolonization and the opening of Africa and independence, and I was a Kwame Nkrumah fan and all that kind of stuff. I was optimistic. I'm a worldly old man nowadays. That optimism is not with me.
Let me interrupt for a second, because in the podcast I just recorded, Kwame Nkrumah was spoken of. But also, this reminds me of a seminar I attended before even I met you, given by Ali Mazrui, in which his proposal for world peace was to give nuclear bombs to everybody. And he was the only person of color, the only person from a less developed country, third world country, global south, depending on the idiom, present. And I think I was the only person apart from him who wasn't in need of the emergency room attention, because I saw a number of incipient heart attacks occurring around the room.
I presume this is not part of the podcast.
This is part of the podcast.
Oh, okay. Fascinating.
It was amazing. And his simple point, complicated point, was, why do you trust us less than you trust yourselves? It was a wonderful remark. Yeah. But back to what you're saying, Prof. So there's an interesting continuity one can discern between the two books so far apart, and so far apart in terms of what has happened with geopolitics. And there's something in there about being the lad from Nottingham who survived nicotine poisoning when working in the cigarette factory, thinking times can only get better.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's bizarre. And just because we're having this laugh, it doesn't mean that I'm not seriously concerned about the nature of the way the world works. And I know you are too. But if it's not for the podcast, if we're being kind of autobiographical, then over a 50-year academic life, you can actually carve it up into different intellectual periods. And in part, the reason that my intellectual drift came like this was purely serendipitous. I mean, the fact that a 24-year-old kid finishing a PhD on Africa finished up in Tasmania, for God's sake, completely changed the way I thought about the world. The fact that I actually had to start teaching about Australia when I went to ANU made me think differently about the world. And to bring it full circle, one of the interesting things about teaching nowadays is age gives you an advantage, but a disadvantage. The advantage it gives you is you have a depth and breadth of knowledge that your students think of as bizarre. But it makes it incredibly difficult for you to try and put things in clear, simple perspectives for students who want security of knowledge and direction. And so they either think you're a dithering old man who doesn't know what you want, or occasionally you get a student who thinks you really do know what you're talking about. that the ones that think you know what you're talking about are far and fewer in between than the ones who think, what's this old drone going on about? I'll finish on that.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Richard Higgett. It's always instructive, educational, and inspirational to read your work and to talk to you. Greatly appreciate it, Richard.
Toby, it's lovely to see you too, mate.